people want to know your story. The vast majority of Americans are not farmers. You know, what you're doing with this process is you're bringing your farm closer to your customer, and that's what you need to do.
Welcome to the 379th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. There's nothing like a colorful Instagram photo of a farmer standing hip-high in a field of wheat or oats to get the attention of eaters seeking healthy food raised in a way that benefits the land and rural communities. It sends a simple, feel-good message. Here's someone who stands behind the food they raise. And then, when a farmer takes the next step and puts their name on a bag of flour or other product that's milled from that grain, an even closer connection is made between the field and the fork. Gilbert Williams is a big proponent of this type of what he calls farmer-forward marketing. In 2009, he and a partner launched Lonesome Stone Milling with rented buildings and used equipment in southwestern Wisconsin. During the next dozen years, the mill developed a demand for locally produced small grains by, among other things, using marketing and packaging that informed consumers about who the individual farmers were that supplied the grain. Eventually, the flour Lonesome Stone Milling produced found customers in Madison, Wisconsin, and Chicago, and Gilbert became known as the grandfather of local flour milling. Gilbert got out of hands-on grain processing a few years ago when he sold his mill to Meadowlark Farm and Mill in Ridgeway, Wisconsin. Meadowlark is an on-farm milling operation, and Gilbert is excited by the potential such a setup offers for putting income directly into the pocketbooks of grain growers. And as he explained during a recent small grains meeting LSP held at the Madison Mercantile in western Minnesota, Gilbert sees a growing market for local, sustainably raised small grains as eaters seek out the kind of healthy food that can be provided by a regional system that produces and processes such crops. Gilbert also shared with the farmers and other entrepreneurs gathered for the meeting some tips for launching their own milling operation and emphasized the importance of taking full advantage of social media and the internet in general when telling a good marketing story. After the meeting, I chatted with Gilbert about how on-farm processing of small grains such as wheat can help develop resilient agricultural economies while supporting regenerative production systems. He started our conversation by describing how cover cropping, sandy soil, and one farmer's coffee grinder got him involved in the milling business. So Gilbert, we just had a kind of a field day, and then we had a workshop where we talked about some of the possibilities for, as we're putting it here, trying to bring small grains back into an area like western Minnesota. And you have quite a bit of experience working with small grains and milling small grains in Wisconsin in particular. Give me a little background on how you got into that and kind of the growth of your business and what all you were doing with that kind of at its peak, some of the products you were processing, that type of thing. And yeah, kind of what got you into that?
Well, it was the opportunity to work with a partner, Gary Zimmer, who was kind of my hero and a good influence, I might say, on getting this off the ground. I was having what I call a period of creative underemployment, and he invited me to an auction where there was it was the local feed and seed, and the owner was retiring, and quite a bit of equipment was for sale. And there was a seed shed, and in that was a Clipper 29D. And what we were able to do is to buy the Clipper and essentially rent the building. And before we got started, it needed quite a bit of cleanup and repair, and so that we did. And we got started as cleaning rye as a cover crop seed. Now, mind you, this was in what is the Wisconsin River Valley of Wisconsin, and there's a lot of sandy soil, and the farmers on the sandy soil use rye as a cover crop because the roots would enhance the organic matter in the soil and make it so the sand was not draining the water away so quickly. Mm. And then this has been repeated over years and years, and it was kind of a very standard farming practice. And this was the machine that had been basically worn down, and we got her running again, that did the rye cleaning for a lot of the local farmers. Okay. Oh, that was 2009.
Okay.
And it was that summer I also had an organic farmer who got to know me and was a great patron, and he brought in some soft red winter wheat that he wanted cleaned for seed. And so we were able to do that, and I had an assistant working with me, and he said a couple days later, you know, I took that wheat home, and I've been taking some of the rye home, and I grind them up in my coffee grinder, and they made great pancakes. And that kind of led to what was the first product. We called it the Lonesome Stone Pancake Mix, because we were in the town of Lone Rock, and Lonesome Stone was kind of the alter ego name of the place. And so using a local miller who was a baker who had a 20-inch stone Meadows, we got him to grind a couple hundred pounds and started taking this stuff to farmers markets. We found people liked it and came back. And it was basically the quality of the flavor. And the quality of the flavor comes from the soil. And like I mentioned, Gary Zimmer had been a partner. He had been influencing a lot of the farmers in the area on, you know, the right mineral balance in the soil. And the thing is, when you get a good mineral balance in the soil, you get a flavorful grain. Then it's the flavor that makes the customer return.
Yeah, I think you made that point a couple times, that you can, maybe you're going to get that customer the first time because they like the story or the idea of it's local, but it's the flavor that's going to bring them back. Mm-hmm. Kind of flash forward a little bit, when your business was at its peak, what all were you processing, and kind of what was your marketing area? What was kind of the extent of your business?
What we had, or what was the fortunate situation, was next to this old Feed and Seed was the local general store that had become, well, they had specialized in being the local meat locker, and then they were taken over by a company, Black Earth Meats, that used it as a sausage kitchen, but it wasn't making Black Earth Meats any money, so it basically went dormant, and we had the opportunity to rent it. And so basically with rented equipment, or rented buildings and used equipment, we were able to stitch together a milling process. We were able to buy a used Meadows 30-inch Meal Master, the biggest stone that Meadows has, and set up grain milling. And then the first round of wheat was a hard red winter wheat that we could make an all-purpose flour with. And then I started working with some of the farmers I knew in the area to basically, you know, include either a hard red spring or a hard red winter in their crop rotations. The rye was readily available. It was getting the wheat, which just, you know, all I had to do was ask for it. Oh, yeah, sure, we can do that. And, you know, they would get about $12 to $15 a bushel. And that makes it a good option for an organic farmer. And we were really able to explore what it took to make a working system. One of the things we found was the variety Glen was a very good choice for us, and it works well east of the Mississippi, and it's tall, and in an organic situation, you want a tall wheat that will stay above the weeds. Then it's a hard thresher, but it's a good grain for bread baking on a stone mill. It just works well. It's been known as a quality variety. And that's what we got started with. And then we'd use the hard red spring as our bread flour, the hard red winter as our all-purpose. And then the soft red winter was a pastry flour. And the soft red winter would also go into distilleries. So we were kind of able to jump that gap and work with some craft distillers making a vodka out of the soft red winter.
So you had, it sounds like, so you were making flour out of wheat. Was there, what all kinds of, was it just that kind of flour, or what kind of flours were you making?
Stone milled flour. And so we had two products. We had three different wheats making three different grades of flour, and then each one had either the whole wheat version or the sifted version. And it didn't take us too long to find that the biggest seller was the sifted version of the bread flour. That is the one from the spring wheat. Right behind that was, you know, the whole wheat, both all-purpose and bread flour. And then we would make, you know, either a pastry flour or for distillery out of the soft red winter.
So one thing I wanted to ask you about was, so traditionally, small grains was very much a part of the rotation here in the upper Midwest and the lower Midwest and the Midwest in general. It kind of disappeared, and that's part of the reason we're having some of these meetings. There's an interest in bringing small grains back into the rotation, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what what maybe has changed as far as the marketing demand for some of these local small grains. But one of the things I'm wondering is, you being in the business, did you see, you know, part of the reason that they did disappear from the rotation was people felt like the weather issues and disease issues were just too much to, and of course, corn and soybeans became the dominant crops, you know, and we know all that, the reasons for that, the policy backing of that and shifts in consolidation in the markets, that kind of thing. But did you see, when you were in the business of milling, were we seeing better varieties that were better adapted to kind of the current situation we have with our weather conditions here in the upper Midwest, or changes in what was available to plant, that kind of thing? I mean, because you were obviously able to get enough wheat in the part of Wisconsin that you were in to make a viable business.
Yes, it was not easy, and I admit I had to buy, during the course of the business, 2 semi-truckloads from a farmer I got to know in North Dakota, eastern North Dakota, just outside of Fargo. But, you know, we tried to keep it as close as we can. I sold the business to John and Hallie Wepking, who formed Meadowlark Community Mill and were able to build from the ground up a good milling system. I retired after we sold all the inventory during the COVID outbreak. Along the way, I believe it was 2012, one of the owners at a company called Madison Sourdough, that's Madison, Wisconsin, they're an excellent sourdough baker, he wanted to try the variety Turkey Red, drove out to Jennings, Kansas, and comes back with a tote full. And I split that between 3 farmers just to try it, and it grew very well. Although, you know, it has the traditional grain, or the heritage grain susceptibilities to disease, which was vomit toxin. But at the time, there was a demand for that. The heritage grain, which would have a gentler gluten, is the best way I can describe it. And for a while was, you know, a hit. And we were, I think, the first company in the area that could at least process that into flour. And the Turkey Red sold very well for a few years. Now, the Turkey Red, in terms of heritage grains, has kind of been superseded more by the what I would call the ancient grains, which would include the spelt, emmer, einkorn, and the farro is what you would call it, that family of grains. But that is to say, you know, again, our best variety was the Glen, which is a tall modern wheat and a very good baker. Its quality of baking flour is, I think, what's important here. You know, if you're looking for a gentler gluten or a non-gluten, you're not going to have the same, you know, the rise and what's essentially the plasticity that the gluten brings. So, you know, let's say that it's the different wheats will make a different product, but these different products have different applications. And so that did work well for us.
Yeah, so you were able to get some varieties that can work in this climate. Let's talk a little bit about then the marketing. It sounds like you were able to hit it at a time when there was more, and you talked about this a little bit today, there's more of an interest in baking with these ancient grains and these traditional grains and really looking at the nutrient density, that type of thing. So it sounds like there's been more of an interest in that.
Well, there's been an increasing awareness. I think Turkey Red was at the forefront of the interest. And, you know, I think today it is heritage grains, you know, that need dehulling. And let me also say, I think the dehulling equipment is much better now than it was 15 years ago when I was fussing with it for, you know, the heritage grains, because even the spelt comes in a hull. It's much easier to dehull than oats. Oats was always a tough dehuller. You know, so I think it's more easily available as a dehulled grain now than it was a while back. And that is a good thing for the ancient grain marketplace for those who are interested.
Where were you, like what was the geographic area you were marketing your product in?
We were located, the mill was located in Lone Rock, Wisconsin, which is about an hour west of Madison. And so once a week we drive a van into Madison and make stops at, you know, the regular customers, the grocery stores, the food co-op, Madison Sourdough, and some restaurants. And then that grew into marketing into Chicago. And for that, we got a distributor. And although he was taking about a third of the money, we got into some pretty good Chicago businesses who were buying basically about a pallet a month. And even though our flour was more expensive, one of the tricks is you can mix, say, the whole wheat with the white flour and still retain a good bit of the flavor. It was the flavor that people liked. It adds character to the bread. And I remember one of those big customers was Middlebrow Brewing, who in the morning was a coffee shop and bakery, and then in the afternoon, a pizza operation with a small beer brewery, and quite popular in the Lincoln Park area of Wisconsin, of Chicago.
We've had a lot of interest. We had a big small grains workshop in January down in southeastern Minnesota in Albert Lea. Huge turnout of farmers who were interested in that. There was a lot of talk about there's an oat processing facility that's trying to get started down there. We had a good turnout here today, and we learned a little bit about what Sandhill Mill is doing with on-farm processing, that type of thing. Noreen Thomas talked a little bit about what she's doing up in the Red River Valley with value-added, some of her grains that she's raising. So getting into small grains and raising them is one thing, getting that into the rotation. But then taking that next step and getting involved with the value added and the processing is a whole nother world, and not for everybody. But you've been through that. Do you have any advice for someone who is maybe just starting to look into something like this? What are some things that they should be aware of? Maybe some missteps that they could avoid, maybe some missteps you made that they could avoid.
Well, okay, in this day and age, you want to design for food safety. So that is on the milling end, you've got to have a very, say, rodent-proof facility that is forklift accessible. You're probably going to be dealing in totes, and you want to be able to mill out of a hard-sided tote into a mill. You have the Meadows Mills, and you have the New American Mills is the primary two mills in the United States. Then there's the Otter Roller from Germany or Austria, I can't remember which. But there's a good choice of milling equipment there. And then you have the steps between the farm and the mill, which is the grain cleaners. And this is where, you know, step one, you're probably going to need an air screen cleaner. That technology has not changed much from the older wooden grain cleaners, primarily the Clipper and the Crippen. But you can, after you go through that, you need a secondary step, which can actually be a color sorter. And it's the newer color sorters are able to sort out a good bit of the DON hot wheat, or the vomitoxin or Fusarium head scab infected wheat. And, you know, I think that combination of an air screen cleaner, you might need an aspirator, a good aspirator after that, and then a color sorter would make a food-grade millable flour out of something that, as a raw grain, was not sellable in the food-grade commodity. And then secondly, by going with a stone mill, and then you want some kind of sifter so that at about a whole wheat flour, you'd want about a 24-gauge screen on, and for a sifted flour, you'd want a 60-gauge screen. And I'd say with that combination of equipment, you're ready to roll. But then you also have sort of throughput and bottlenecks, and you got to know what those are. For example, your grain cleaning system is going to operate kind of independently. And when you've got clean grain, that's actually marketable either in totes or in 50-pound bags to home bakers. And then your milling, you know, I'd say set up for being able to drop it in out of a 50-pounder, not a 50-pounder, I mean a one-ton tote. And then your milling system, you know, when I ran Lonesome Stone, we were a small town operation where the old general store backed up to the old feed and seed. But it seems as though it's best placed on the farm. But that farm is going to need three-phase power to run the milling equipment. And that way, you're farmer-owned, so that you've got fewer people in the game, and the farmer is selling the value-added product rather than selling to a mill, and then the mill sorts, winnows and sifts, basically, and then sells the product.
And that's kind of the situation. You sold your equipment to Metal Art
Yes.
Organics, and that's the situation they're in. They're on farm and all of that right now.
Yes, they are on farm. And the thing is, they're, you know, depends on the year, 300 to 400 acres of various wheats grown on their farm, but they're also a market for a lot of other local, these are the ridgetop driftless area farms, because on the ridgetop, as opposed to the Wisconsin River Valley, you have more wind, you have quicker drying, you have lower vomit toxin. So I'd say the region that you're choosing is also important, although it worked, you know, wheat was very much of an essential grain back before big agriculture took over. And remember, it was the price of corn and beans and the availability to, or the ability to use that as animal feed. And then in today's market to make ethanol out of corn has driven a lot of the big farm markets. But, you know, we may be 5% of the farmer's market, or we may be 5% of the farmers and 5% of the market, but it is the premium 5% of the market.
At your peak, do you know roughly how many farmers you were buying from and how many acres that represented?
Well, let's see. I know I had 6 organic farmers, and I had about 3 or 4, depending on the year and what they grew, that were transitional. And the market turns out where the wholesale in the restaurant business has to be very price conscious. So they would pay, you know, a lower amount, probably about 40 cents a pound, 40 to 50 cents a pound for what we could make out of what we tried to call tradition or, well, transition or sustainably grown. And then you had the home bakers, and they're the ones who want the certified organic. And it was the food co-op and the high-priced grocery store that carry organic labels. And they would, you know, be the ones who would buy the organic. But you kind of had 2 different markets. And I realize I'm sort of competing against myself here. So one thing that Meadowlark did is they were all organic, and they've continued to be all organic. And I think, you know, I was, say, the pilot scale test of a local milling system, and they are the full scale, well-running system, you know. Yeah. And, you know, truthfully, I never made a lot of money, or I barely broke even on a lot of cases, and, you know, made the most money when we sold it to Meadowlark. But somebody needs to be out there as the pioneer, and somebody needs to do it first. And at least as an older farmer, I call this the old miller's tale of this is how we do things, or how I did things, which was in the you know, the 5 to 20 years ago time. So, you know, a lot has been learned. I'm an older white-haired guy, and I still can think and answer questions.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I appreciate that you're able to, you're willing to answer questions. Do you know, like, of those, you said around maybe half a dozen farmers you were buying regularly from, how many acres that represented?
Oh, gosh, I don't recall at this point, but it's basically, think of it this way, about a 20-acre field with a good small grain yield, I'd say greater than 50 bushels, is going to fill up a semi-truck and maybe then some. And it's the measurement of grain in truckloads is kind of the way it goes. And, you know, then a truckload is about 800 bushels, 800 to 900 bushels, if you're legal or not. And then that would relate to, oh, you know, 50,000 pounds of grain, which probably relates to about 40,000 pounds of flour. And, you know, that's kind of how we would demarcate the process. So it's too far gone in my memory of how many acres they were.
Yeah, but. Yeah. So maybe, I don't know, it wasn't thousands of acres, but hundreds of acres.
Right.
Maybe
we're talking. Meadowlark is well over 1 million pounds a year now. And, you know, sir, they've grown into a local market. And, you know, they try to buy as close to home as possible.
So you had some, you talked a little bit about some marketing advice you would have for somebody if they have gotten to the point where they're doing some on-farm processing and trying to enter into that direct marketing, wholesale markets, that type of thing. What's some of the marketing advice you'd have?
One is the farmer forward, or that's basically the big picture. But it's get yourself out there in your nice crop of wheat and take a picture with a big smile on your face. This is your wheat, your product, you're proud of it, and make sure that picture is accessible on the internet to your customers as possible. Then in the milling process, put your name on the label. That's what people want to see. People want to know your story. And the vast majority of Americans are not farmers. And, you know, what you're doing with this process is you're bringing your farm closer to your customer. And that's what you need to do.
Well, you had made the point that the internet and social media specifically has just revolutionized this kind of value-added marketing.
Yes, yeah. I honestly don't know where we'd be without it, because this is, the local value-added marketing is really benefiting from social media and the ability for, you know, a single farm to communicate what it has to the potential market, you know, and the ability to stay away from the large commodity markets that are big companies screwing farmers.
So can you talk a little bit about this idea of being a mission-driven business? It sounds like that's very important as well.
Well, yeah, you got to have people who believe in what you're doing, and they are out there, and they are the farmers. You know, they want to see the mill succeed. And so it's thinking of how would you set up something like this? It's, I would say, small milling co-ops that could have a brand label. Remember that branding and labeling as a recognizable logo is also very important. And, you know, something that's either a catchy name or a memorable name is important. So your product will be known to people who choose to eat healthy.
That's a good point. You also made the point, you were a pioneer. You felt like you never really made...
I didn't get rich.
But I think you even said you feel like today you would need $1 million in sales to really make it a profitable venture. But you got to start somewhere. And so it sounds like if somebody can tap into that market and get enough volume, but not get so big that they're not a local regional business anymore, that maybe that's the trick to making something like this work.
Yes. You know, make it a signature farm. You know, again, it goes back to the label, sort of the logo, the idea, you know, the know your farmer, the farmer forward. Don't be modest about who you are as a farmer. You know, say, I'm a farmer and I'm proud of it, and this is what I do, and I make good food, and here you go. And that's the way to get your customers.
Being somebody who kind of pioneered this, and now you've been able to pass on to the business and see it kind of carried on a larger scale, and then going to things like this where you see there is a fair amount of interest amongst farmers and local business people in this kind of thing, how do you feel? That there is maybe a future for some from these regional mills? Because that is one of the big, when I talk to farmers and to people who want to bring small grains back into the upper Midwest, they say that's one of the big blockades or one of the big stumbling blocks is regional processing that's accessible, that I don't have to drive half a state away or a state away to get my product there and then to get it back and burning up all my profits and transportation, that type of thing. I mean, do you see some potential for more of that kind of regional milling type of situation?
Well, it's market development is what I would say is important there. And it's having a milling system, say, associated with a community. So that community is your market. Remember, we all have to eat. And then, it was about a year ago, I went to field day, and I met a young guy there who I had known as, he was a banjo player in the group that would play at the farmer's market. And he recognized me and shook my head, and he said, you know, you're the grandfather of all this local milling. And that really made my day.
It should.
For more information on localized grain processing and the role it can play in diversifying cropping operations, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 379 at landstewardshipproject.org. On that page, you'll find links to interviews we recently did with Noreen Thomas and Peter and Brittany Haugen, who also have extensive experience with adding value to locally raised small grains and marketing them. During our interview, Gilbert Williams mentioned his original partner, Gary Zimmer, who's a pioneer in his own right when it comes to organic farming and soil health. On our podcast page, you can find a link to an interview I did with Gary a while back. To say the least, it was a high-energy conversation. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.